For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay, friends, it's that time to begin. It's such an honor that you've chosen this workshop. I hope that you can gain something that will be of practical value in the way that you end up relating to people from another culture, that you can serve in Christ-like attitude. This is cross-cultural servanthood. And I'm Rich Mendola. Just a little bit about my background. I've been working among international students for the past 34 years. For the last 23 of those, it's been here in Columbus with an organization called International Friendships. And it's not only in Columbus, it's in other places. And my focus is not going to be on the work that IFI is doing, but there'll be opportunities for any of you who would like to connect with international students as one application of what we're doing, and I'll be sharing a little bit about that. I'm assuming that you're here because you have a current friend from another culture that you would like to grow in friendship with, or you feel God is calling you into some type of cross-cultural ministry, somehow that you recognize a need and a desire to learn how to better relate to people cross-culturally. I hope that's why you're here in some way, because that's what this is about. Okay, well, let me ask you a simple question here. What character quality do people from other cultures, should be cultures there, find most offensive about Americans? Like, normally they wouldn't tell you this, like, because most cultures around the world are what are called honor-shame cultures. And so part of that is not wanting to embarrass you or to cause you social discomfort. So a lot of times people will, one of the problems is for Americans, we are very direct and about our feedback, but other cultures are not so direct. So you will not, like, most of the time if you ask someone this question, they're not gonna answer this question, okay? But I know the answer to this question. So what do you think it is? Is it, you know, what could it be? Okay, loudness would be something that might be related to this in some way. Pushy. What's that?
Too pushy.
Too pushy?
Too affectionate.
Too affectionate, okay, yes?
Harper has said it was that people look down on this culture and think they're like third world, all poor, ignorant people.
Okay, now that expression and some of these things will relate, but the thing that people sense and react to is pride. Now, some of the things that were mentioned are some of the things that we get to as how people perceive that we are proud. Now, there's two types of pride. There's the type of pride where the Bible says that we think of ourselves more highly than we ought. That is, our view is what was expressed here, whether it's true or not. If we are actually looking down on someone from another culture, if we feel like we are better or superior or more knowledgeable or just whatever, it says that we think of ourselves higher than we ought, that's a type of pride. I think all of us realize very clearly that God calls us to be humble and not proud. And we would like to think of ourselves, although we know we're in a spiritual struggle and we don't want to be proud, and I think the reality is that it's difficult to detect pride in our own lives. And one of the things that we want to do as we go through this session, since this is at the heart, the difference between pride and being humble, and we're talking about cross-cultural servanthood, and essential to the quality of a servant is being humble. So if we can't learn how to detect pride and get rid of it, we cannot successfully be a servant. The two things are related, and that's why we have to really deal with the problem of pride. And as we go through this session, part of it is to help us uncover pride. One form of pride that is deep in the human heart is what's called ethnocentrism. Ethnocentrism, ethno means ethnic, or it relates to culture. And centrism means central. So it's the idea that your culture is the best. Now, the reality is that ethnocentrism is not a problem simply in American culture. It's in the heart of many cultures. The difference, partly, is that in America, we are very upfront and outspoken about the idea that America is the best. Other countries do that in some way, but America is much more forward in advancing the idea that we are the most technologically advanced, we just whatever you want to add to it, the most educated. A lot of messages that come about America's special role in the world. And now, as Christians, to separate that out and to understand how that has affected our view of the world as Christians is difficult. It often gets mixed together and we can't always identify it. So we need to. So we may have actual pride in our heart that needs to be rooted out. And that is a work of God, an ongoing work of God, where He reveals to us the levels and the depths to which pride is affecting the way we deal with other people. Okay. But there's also perceived pride. That is, that's unrelated to what's actually in your heart. It's just how other people see you. Based on your behavior and their interpretation of your behavior, their conclusion is that you are proud. Now, it may be that in particular situations, the way you're acting, you do not have anything in your heart that is looking down on another person or thinking yourself better than another person, but because of the way you're approaching, they say you are proud. And some of the things that were mentioned here, aggressiveness, being pushy, being loud, those things could be perceived by other people as an evidence that you are proud in some way. And one of the realities is even for cross-cultural workers who go overseas, who are often deciding to live a seemingly sacrificial life in view of the life that they're leaving, that missionaries all discover sometimes that when they're serving, that the people they're serving see them as proud. And it's a real obstacle to their successful establishing relationships. So there's both actual pride and perceived pride, and we have to deal with both of those. Okay? Now, here's a classic story that illustrates the problem we have of dealing with ethnocentrism and the problem of pride. It's called The Monkey and the Fish. And it's in your outline. And let's go ahead and read that together here. Okay. It says, a typhoon had temporarily stranded a monkey on an island. In a secure, protected place while waiting for the raging waters to recede, he spotted a fish swimming against the current. This monkey had never seen a fish before, but it seemed obvious to the monkey that the fish was struggling and in need of assistance. Being of kind heart, the monkey resolved to help the fish. A tree precariously dangled over the very spot where the fish seemed to be struggling. At considerable risk to himself, the monkey moved far out on a limb, reached down and snatched the fish from the threatening waters. Immediately scurrying back to the safety of his shelter, he carefully laid the fish on dry ground. For a few moments, the fish showed excitement, but soon settled into a peaceful rest. Joy and satisfaction swelled inside the monkey. He had successfully helped another creature. Okay, so the questions. Okay, first of all, why did the monkey try to help this fish? He had a kind heart. He perceived a need in the fish. He said, look at that fish needs some help. I'm here. I'm going to help the person. So there was a good motivation, right, in this monkey's heart. Now, what did the monkey assume about fish culture? It's the same as his. Okay, this is very obvious from this story. It's not so obvious many times when we're in another culture, these assumptions that we make about another culture, that it's going to be the same as our culture, that people are going to think the same, act the same, value the same. And so the monkey assumed that fish culture would be similar. So how do you think the fish felt about the help it received? If he could have, he would have said, please leave me alone, don't help me. Now, sometimes You know, in the story, it doesn't say if the fish was able to communicate with the monkey or not. But the reality is sometimes people who are being helped do communicate messages that we don't pick up, that they are too polite to tell us that the help we're giving them actually is not the help that they want. Okay, good. All right, and then what advice would you give to the monkey for future situations where he would like to help?
Learn about fish.
Okay. Find out more before you start doing something. Now, this is a difficult situation because, in a sense, he doesn't have a long time to learn about fish culture if he's going to help, because he sees something that he thinks needs his immediate attention. And yet, how? I mean, this is just a story, but what do you think the monkey could have done differently? If he could have asked the fish, that's right, you want my help? Okay, now this is a very instructive story, because one of the cultural characteristics of Americans that we are not always aware of is Americans have a great desire to help others. Now that sounds so noble, and it is a good characteristic. I think it's an honorable characteristic. The problem is that depending on how the helping occurs, helping can be from a position of power or from a position of humility. When helping occurs from a position of power, that is, let me do something for you that you could do, but I'm just going to do it for you. Or if helping comes from the standpoint of saying, I know better for you what you need than what you would want, the helping can be actually a very arrogant type of helping. Helping is complicated, actually. To help people in a way that dignifies them, that honors them, that shows respect to them, is not always easy. And there's lots of byproducts of helping people that are unintended. Sometimes dependency issues come up when we help in the wrong way. Sometimes helping is more for the sake of the person doing the helping to feel good than it is for the person who's being helped. One illustration, there's a number of teams that are sent out from the United States to do what are sometimes referred to as short-term missions. And because of going to places where people have not learned the language, they are limited sometimes in terms of the connections they can make. So usually what teams that go to other countries would like to do is to do some type of project to serve and to help. And many of those projects are very good, but they may have unintended consequences in the way that they help. For example, there was a tremendous outpouring of support after the earthquake occurred in Haiti. And people were genuinely wanted to help the Haitian people who were in a desperate situation. The problem that occurred is the food that was donated to Haiti was so much at the time that food that was grown by Haitian farmers could not be bought. I mean, they couldn't sell their food because there was so much free food that became available after the earthquake. And so the Haitian farmers struggled to be able to support themselves with the crops that they grew, you know. That's a difficult situation. We do want to help, so the issue is not helping, but how could it have, how could the needs of the Haitian farmers been of address too? You know, just a small illustration. So this issue of helping is one we're going to talk more about. Okay, because a servant wants to help. That's part of the idea of a servant. Okay, so now I want you to just turn to someone and answer this question. In what ways might it be possible for you to act like this monkey? Okay, let's make it more personal. How might you sometimes act like a monkey, or could be like a monkey, like this monkey? Okay, all right. Lots of reflection we can do on this question. But now that I got you engaged, now I'm going to get you disengaged here. Yeah. I know I didn't give you enough time, but I wanted to get you thinking about this, you know. Actually, I do pray. I say, God, help me not be like this monkey. But I know, Lord, there's characteristics like me, like this monkey. So please, I do pray that God would do a deeper work so more and more of this spirit of pride would be revealed and removed from me. And I think we need to pray for God's help in this, because it's really easy to be like this monkey. We know Jesus is our model of what it looks like to be a servant. And we say, what does a servant look like? Okay, we look at the life of Jesus Christ. We look at him who, here in being described, you know, this passage in Philippians 2, you know, it says he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And then he went further. He humbled himself by became obedient to death, even death on a cross. Now, we see that in Jesus' life, this occurred in many ways. We see in the incarnation, the actual birth of Jesus, the humbling of himself was evident in the way that he was born in a small town with, you know, not a good physical environment. He was humble in being born into a poor family. That he was humble in the sense that he basically was raised in obscurity, that he probably did work with his hands, assisting his father as a carpenter, that in his life ministry, that he dealt with all different types of people. We never see the type of reaction to Jesus as though he was proud. There's no perceived pride in Jesus, as well as no actual pride in him. We see that in John 13, of course, Jesus, in the washing of the feet of the disciples, gives them a summary picture of what he's actually been doing in his life, that his washing of their feet, taking the lowest servant form of being willing to remove their dirt, which was a spiritual picture of what he was doing, is a model for us of what true servanthood looks like. Now, one of the questions I have for you is, do you think Jesus, the quality of being a servant, is that a essential quality of God? In other words, is Jesus Christ eternally a servant, or was he a servant when he was just on the earth? In other words, you know, for the rest of Philippians talks about the fact that when he went very low, then he became exalted. You know, the honor reversal, that he went low and then now he has the highest name. His name is above every name, that in his name every knee should bow and every tongue confess that he's Lord. So the question is, now that he's reigning in his lordship in heaven, I mean, he was Lord on earth too, is he still a servant now in heaven? Is that was it temporary or is it eternal? What do you think?
I'm thinking of what he makes the reception for.
Yeah. Okay. That is a type of servanthood. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Okay. All right. Yes? Okay. Mm-hmm. I find a very interesting passage in Luke 14, verse 17, which gives a picture of the coming age, the eternal kingdom, where we will go and sit at dinner in the kingdom of God. And it says, it's very interesting, you know, one of the things that happened when Jesus washed his feet, it says he took off his robe. Taking off of the robe, robe being a picture of your covering, so you're not naked. Sometimes robe is also associated with favor and position. That the prodigal son, when he came home, you know, the robe was put on him, but Jesus took off his robe. It's very interesting. It says in heaven that Jesus also takes off his robe and that he serves us the meal. I don't know if you realize what's going to happen at this big banquet, but that Jesus also serves us there. I don't know how that's going to happen. I think that when I think about that scene, I think about what Peter must have felt like when he said, Lord, no, you shouldn't wash my feet. I'm going to feel like in heaven we are supposed to be serving Christ, and we will be serving him, but somehow he's also serving us. So I see the servanthood, the attitude of Christ that's pictured here as a servant, is being an eternal quality of God. That is, I can't get my mind around that. Just, that's what the scripture reveals to us. Okay, so now learning to be a cross-cultural servant is an intentional decision to follow Christ and be like him. Now, we don't decide to be like Christ by our will. It's the transforming work of God in our life. It's the work of the Holy Spirit to make us like Christ. I'm not trying to get into human effort, but what I'm saying is when we make the decision to follow Christ and to want to be like him, one of the things that is essential to that then is learning how to be a servant. And we need to decide that this is something that we want to learn as a disciple of him. We want him to train us to be a servant. Here's some pictures from other cultures of how they picture Christ washing the feet of his disciples. This is from Indian culture. The guy who drew this, very interesting. I don't know why he had trouble, because he put 13 disciples in it, but this is an Ethiopian picture of the foot washing. Okay. Learning to be a cross-cultural servant is a process that involves both heart transformation and specific skills. Now, the good thing about this, okay, we cannot work the heart transformation. It has to come as a result of the work of God. But it's encouraging to me that since skills are also involved, that if we want to improve, that we can improve in being a servant. It is not so mysterious. For some of us, language learning is very difficult. I do not speak a second language fluently. I do believe, however, that if God wanted me to, that I could devote time and attention to learning another language, no matter how difficult it was. In fact, I did ask God that specific question once, because I serve a lot of Chinese students. And when I was in China once, and I was trying to, God brought me into a situation where I was in two situations where I really felt this strong burden to speak Chinese. I was in a clothing store in Beijing, and I was shopping by myself and looking for a tie. And some old men were watching me with great interest to see how I was doing. You know, they just were standing there watching me. And I was trying to negotiate with the guy selling the tie, and he couldn't speak English. And we were doing what we could to communicate. And these guys were just looking and smiling, you know. So I looked at them, and I smiled at them, and we went on our way. And, you know, Beijing, how many people are in Beijing? I think 12 million or 15 million. I can't remember. At least 12 million. So later in the week, I'm walking in the city of Beijing, and who do I bump into but one of these guys? Now, it's not, God is not random, right? So I realize I'm meeting this guy for a purpose, and I want to tell him about Jesus, but I can't speak Chinese. So I was like so frustrated. We smiled at each other, you know, and he recognized me, I recognized him. And then there was another situation where I was talking to some other people, and a people found it quite interesting that I was talking to this one person. So a very large crowd assembled around me, and I realized, oh, this is my chance to preach the gospel. But I couldn't speak Chinese, and I didn't have an interpreter, and I didn't want to get my friend in trouble that I was visiting. So I went home and I prayed. I said, Lord, do you want me to learn Chinese? Because I'll learn Chinese as difficult as Chinese. And now you're going to think this is me getting myself off the hook, but I really felt like God spoke to me and said, no, I don't want you to learn Chinese. He said, if you would study my word for as many hours as you would study Chinese to become fluent in Chinese, I will use you more among the Chinese in America than if you studied Chinese. So I was very glad. Yeah, that's not an excuse. I'm just saying I was willing. I did get to a place of willingness to learn. I think in this particular case, there has to be a willingness to practice and learn the skills that are going to go along with learning true servanthood. So let's go ahead. There's six basic skills and attitudes. There are both attitudes and skills that we can learn. I'm trying to give you something, and as we go through these, you can, you know, do the self-examination to see which area or areas could you grow in. And the model, the overview of this process is in this picture. Now, this picture, actually, I'm fortunate, in your diagram that you have, it was there's been some modifications since that original diagram. Okay, what this is saying is the foundational attitudes or skills, there's three of them over here, openness, acceptance, and trust. And what this is saying is when you're going to go into a cross-cultural relationship or live in another culture, there's going to be cultural differences. When you experience those cultural differences, you're going to experience these types of things. If you're just a tourist and you're oblivious to things and you're living in your own world, you may not experience them. But as soon as you start developing relationships or being there longer, you're going to have some frustrations, some confusion, some tension, and some embarrassment because you don't know how things work. You don't understand why people are doing things the way they are. It's not the same as you're used to. It's uncomfortable for you. And just one illustration, I just went to India recently, and when I was in India, one of the phenomena in India is that people don't line up, you know, and if you want something, you can't be passive. If you're passive, you never get even your food ordered. Like the way the food is ordered, you have to have a ticket and everyone's putting their ticket out, and if you're just holding your ticket like this, they never take your ticket. In fact, one of the tough readjustments that my Indian friends that I was visiting when they went back to India, they had gotten so used to the way we did it in America that they were experiencing the discomfort of people kind of pushing and just that way of, we would call it aggressiveness. I don't think they would call it aggressiveness. They would call it getting things done or just the way things are. But it feels like aggressiveness to someone who's not used to that type of environment. So that's a kind of a frustration that you experience. Okay, so you experience the frustration. Now, if you come in with these attitudes, if you learn how to be open and accepting and trusting, you're more likely to come out and learn from those situations, better understand why these things are done differently, what's behind them, because there's other values that usually shape these things. And then you'll come out being able to build the type of relationships where you can actually serve people properly. So these are the skills here and the attitudes that we're looking at. Now, on the other hand, if you go in with suspicion and fear, if you generally reject things that are different than you do them, if you're easily offended, then when you go through these things, you end up criticizing, rationalizing, and withdrawing, which of course ends up not producing any type of relationships. So that's what we're looking at. This is a really simple thing of how you can be successful in crossing culture and how you can end up coming out as a cross-cultural servant. Okay, is that understandable? Okay, so let's do the first one, openness. The definition, and by the way, these definitions come from this book on cross-cultural servanthood. Duane Elmer, they do have copies of it down here, he is my kind of mentor in this area of cross-cultural work. He is a professor at Trinity, and he's deeply influenced me and So a lot of his stuff is in this, and I'm indebted to him. So if you want a much more thorough treatment, if this topic, if you get stimulated this, you want to go deeper, you can get this book and read about it. But he defines it as the ability to welcome people into your presence and make them feel safe. You know, I'm going to be talking another session about hospitality. And hospitality is a very practical expression of openness. In order to practice hospitality, you need to have this quality in your life. But one of the ways you show openness is by welcoming people into your space, and welcoming them into the deeper level. As long as people are on the outside, you're not fully open to them. And that's why openness always involves risk, always involves the aspect of being misunderstood, being taken advantage of, being rejected. But people who know who they are in Christ can learn to be open and be able to welcome people. Now, some very practical skills related to that is, number one, the first part of openness is learning how the initial greeting goes when you welcome people. You may want to welcome people, like someone once said, too affectionate. You know, if you're coming from a non-touching culture and you immediately are touching people, you're probably going to make them feel uncomfortable. And even though that's the way you want to show how much you're welcoming them, you need to learn how people, this is very simple, very basic, I know, but we do need to understand this. And maybe another simple thing about this is, this goes again to understanding honor and shame cultures. I'm going to keep referring to that because most of the people in the world come from honor and shame culture. And there's some things that relate to that about how you welcome people. One of the things that usually in honor cultures, when you're welcoming someone, you use a gift as part of the welcome. And gift giving is a very important thing in much of the world. And Americans are not too skilled at gift giving. I mean, we give gifts, but not in the level and the way that people in the rest of the world give gifts. And so we should learn from them. We should learn from other people how to give gifts, especially on, you know, when you're greeting people. Now, you're shaking your head over there. Tell me why you're shaking your head. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. So how do we learn it? I mean, this is partly where you can do some study. It's really good if you have a cultural interpreter that you can ask for what's appropriate to bring. I know that friends think carefully before they come to the United States about bringing gifts with them that they want to give you as part of the welcome when they're meeting you, you know, if you help them particularly in some way. Okay. Sure.
So we do a monthly dinner with international students at our house with our home group Bible study. And this one guy was new, and my dining room has now become tiny because I've received so many gifts. I don't want to stick in the closet. So I was like, okay, we have an Italian bistro to China. So this kid walks into our dining room, and he's just standing there, like, smelling stuff like this. And I had just hung up two the silk kind of painting, the roll, I can't remember what they're called. And I think he goes, I'm smelling Chinese ink. Like he could smell the thing off these pictures. And when I walked in and I was like, oh, you know, yeah, I was explaining the room. And he goes, yeah, I smell Chinese ink. And I'm like, oh, well, I just hung up these two paintings. And he's like, that's it. Uh-huh. He was like smelling the table. He couldn't figure out what it was.
Wow. That's amazing.
Smell like home.
Yeah, smell like home. Okay. I'm not going to be able to go into depth on each of these points, but number two is recognize, resist, and reject the practice of negative attribution. The way you do that is by suspending judgment. Negative attribution is the quality when we, back in that chart, okay. When you go through these things, when something occurs that you don't understand, negative attribution is the mechanism by which you almost always come to a negative conclusion about the thing that you don't understand. And that quality, that's kind of like a natural response that we need to learn to recognize. Now, not everyone has it in the same way, but social sciences study the fact that in our interactions with people, especially from the West, this is not true everywhere, but especially in the West, because of us being a guilt culture, innocence culture, we are tending to make evaluative judgments about what is right and wrong, what is good and bad. You say, well, doesn't everybody do that? Actually, no, not everybody does that. I mean, not every culture is oriented in that way. What that means is when we see somebody, we are tending to evaluate them. And how can we evaluate people when we first meet them? We're evaluating them primarily on their physical appearance and on their mannerisms and on things as to whether or not they match what we consider good. And this is a unconscious thing that occurs. The evaluation is usually made, initially when we meet people, is usually made within the first 4 seconds, or they say 2.5 seconds of meeting someone, that we've already looked at them and made a decision, can I relate to this person or not? And, you know, the wider our bandwidth comes, that we are like Jesus, that we can say, I can relate to all different kinds of people. You know, one of the things that I wanted to do in my life, I work with international students, so I work with people from lots of different cultures, lots of different backgrounds, but I wanted to keep in touch with my own culture too and learn to relate to different people in my own culture. So for years, I would try to purposely go and meet people that I was generally not in relation with so that I could be stretched and learn from other people. I remember the year I decided that I was going to try and make some friends with some punk rockers. And this is the way I usually dress, you know. I mean, this is my normal dress all the time. So they dress a little bit differently and different hairstyles usually than me. So the outward differences are there, you know. And but I said, oh, I recognize the feeling of discomfort I had in me because I didn't know exactly their culture or that I didn't grow up as a punk rocker. I didn't listen to the music or anything like that. So, but anyway, I'm just saying I wanted to, for myself, stretch. And I found out, you know, I had some really good conversations with people, friends. They became friends, and you know, they were people. They had their needs, and I could listen to them and learn from them. So. I'm trying to do that in my life, to stretch my bandwidth for what type of people I can relate to without having a negative judgment on them, you know, just because of the way they look. I think the reality is we don't have enough information to make judgments about people. We don't know their character. We don't know what's in their heart. And that's why we can't judge people, why Jesus says we can't judge. But we do it. So we have to learn to recognize our thoughts that come. Let me give you an illustration of how negative attribution works. Duane Elmer had lived in South Africa, and when he was in South Africa, he had gone there as a missionary to serve. He had gone there a number of years ago after apartheid was abolished, and he was there doing some teaching, and early in his stay, when he was on his way to a meeting to teach, he wasn't quite sure where it was, and he was getting anxious because he needed help finding where to go. So in America, if you need directions, at least before you have GPSs and cell phones with GPSs in them, us old timers, what would you do if you needed directions someplace? Go to a gas station. Okay. So he went to a gas station and asked for directions. And he said, you know, I need to go here. And the person said, well, you know, go this way and go there. And then he went, followed the directions that were given, and he ended up knowing, after a while he figured out, this can't possibly, these directions could not, I know, I didn't know exactly where to go, but I know this is not in the right direction. So he started getting, you know, upset, because of course he was going to be late for his meeting, and one of the Western values is being on time. So he's operating in that, and so he eventually gets there, but he's very late. And he's just thinking about this guy who gave him the wrong directions and trying to process the confusion and the embarrassment that he had. And he said, why didn't the guy, if he didn't know which way to tell me to go, why didn't you just tell me that? What was his problem? You know, why? He just was really like thinking negatively about that experience. And then it happened a second time, the same type of thing. And now he's starting to process it. And he says, you know, started thinking about what possibly could be going on in this situation. And his conclusion was, he said, well, maybe because of the system of apartheid, because I'm white and they're black, maybe they're getting back at me. Maybe this is their devious way of saying, oh, you were our oppressors for a long time. I can't do much, but I can do this to you. Now imagine with those type of thoughts in his mind, and he's supposed to be serving in that culture. So he's starting to view people from the viewpoint of being untrusting, devious, you know, maybe even malicious. It's kind of hard to serve people when you think that's maybe their general characteristic. Well, what he didn't know was that there was a value in that culture that said one of the rudest things you could do, one of the ways that you could show such dishonor to someone is if they ask you for help and you say, I'm sorry, I cannot help you. That would be like a terrible thing to do. So it's better to do the best you can, even if it's not quite right, because you're still showing that you want to help the person. That's what you're communicating. I do want to help you. Now, we might say, don't help me in that way. But that's not going to work. If you ask for help, the person has to help you. I mean, in the sense that not to help you would be a terrible thing. So the person does the best they can. Now, if you understand that's what's going on, that gives you a much different impression. But the problem was he was practicing negative attribution, trying to understand the difference and giving it a negative conclusion. And we tend to go in that direction. So this is a really important thing if we're going to be open to suspend judgment. Don't make a conclusion what's going on in the situation. I still remember the first time when I was young in international student ministry and I started to make Chinese friends and I was having a conversation with a guy, and as we were talking, he grabbed my hand and held onto my hand. And so we're holding hands. And I remember the feeling inside of me, like, aren't you going to let go of my hand? Why are you holding my hand? Now, I didn't say that to him. I just a feeling, but I recognized, I caught this thing. I said, I don't know what's going on. I don't know why this is happening, but if he wants to hold my hand, I'll let him hold my hand. So we had this long conversation just holding hands, you know, and I said, I'm going to let him be the one to disconnect from me. I won't pull my hand away. And so we talked a long time holding hands. And then afterwards, I asked one of my Chinese friends, so this guy was holding my hand. What's that mean? And he said, oh, that means you're a friend. That's what friends do. They hold hands. I said, oh, I'm so glad I didn't pull my hand away. What would that have communicated to him? You know, if he was comfortable enough with me, seeing me as a friend in that way, and I wasn't really rejecting him. I was just saying there's a culture difference. But I needed to suspend judgment. Oh, this guy, you know, he's doing something to intrude on my space or whatever. Okay, it's a very simple thing, right? So we need, he tells the story of being in a situation in Africa where they were with a group of people, and as they were saying hello, that the elderly man spit on the head of his son twice. Now, the boy looked at his mom and said, he just spit on me. And the mom practiced this and said, yes, but we don't know what it means. Now, in our culture, we would know what that would mean. I mean, it would be very clear. I can't think of an instance where someone spitting on you is a good thing. Okay? It only means something negative. But she suspended judgment. She said, let's find out what it means. Well, it turned out that the meaning of that was that in that part of Africa, there's not a lot of rain. So the rain is seen as being something so precious as a gift from God. It's a type of blessing when it rains. And The spitting on a person is a picturing of the blessing of God, because it's associated with water and like rain falling on the person. So you spit on the person in order to say, I want the rain to be falling on you, like you to be blessed. Now, an American might say, can't you come up with a different way of blessing me? Okay? We might say that, but hey, if you grow up that way and that's what it means, I mean, we talked about the greetings. It's the emotional component that we've been trained in that we have to recognize and overcome. I still feel uncomfortable, and it's okay to feel uncomfortable, even though I recognize, I still feel uncomfortable when a woman from Latin America kisses me on both sides of the cheek. And that's the way they greet me. You know, it's like, I'm married. Don't kiss me on the cheek. But that's what they're comfortable with, and they do it. So, okay. So do you understand this point about what it means to suspend judgment? This being a critical thing of being open? Any questions about this? Okay, three. The opposite of that would be intentionally think the best of people. To develop a type of attitude to think about the fact that people are not going to intentionally try and hurt you. Yes, there are evil, malicious people, and we all have evil in our hearts, and we all have a sinful human nature, but that should not slant our view. Jesus, although he didn't entrust himself to anyone from the standpoint of knowing the hearts of men, I don't see in Jesus' life that he went around just thinking, oh man, look at all these bad people, you know? They're so bad. He knew people, but he still saw some positive things. The image of God is in all of us. It's not just evil there. There is the mark of God in our lives. And so I think we ought to, people can sense if we look at them positively or negatively. We need to develop that thinking the best of people as an approach. Tolerating ambiguity kind of goes with the second one, but I talked about that bandwidth, the idea that one of the other things about American society and American culture is we tend to be a culture that likes closure. We like things that are more defined. A lot of other cultures are what are called fluid cultures. They're not so defined. And so there's a lot more ambiguity. And Americans who like closure, when we go and are with people that are fluid or things are not well defined, we feel uncomfortable. Now, it's partly a personality thing. I realize that's a generalization of Americans, but we're just talking about tendencies. And I think it's a little bit, this is also a generational thing too. I think younger people younger generation in America does much better with ambiguity than the older generation. Maybe also partly when you get older, you don't have as much flexibility. So we have to learn how to tolerate ambiguity if we're going to be open, which is the skill we're talking about. That skill about the first basic skills that we're learning to develop cross-cultural relationships is having openness. Okay? And then learn how to avoid black and white categories when dealing with cultural differences. And we need to really work at this. Now let me, I started by saying how difficult it is to identify the problem of pride in our heart and the way that works cross-culturally. Let me try to illustrate that further. Maybe it sounds so obvious to you. Maybe you're saying, why am I harping on this so much? But I have found for my own life that it is a lot harder than it seems. I may get the point intellectually, but then to actually do it is very difficult. So let's take out that sheet that's in the back of your handout called How Western Are You? In terms of traditional values. Now, in the U.S., there are subcultures, there are variations. I would say that this is primarily more of a Caucasian-based value system. And so, you know, I don't know that it would be true for, it's not true for all Americans, okay? But it's been a general pattern in the larger American society. So I'm not saying that it's true for all Americans, but these are traditional values, okay? Now, when we read these questions, if you have a response to any of these questions, like, you mean someone would think differently? You mean someone would answer this question differently? You are catching yourself into a mode of then being careful. That's where you would say, wow, I could easily fall into That's bad to be different. Okay, let's take the first one. Do you believe it's good to be goal-oriented and have specific goals that you can work on in life? Would someone say no? I mean, let's see. I mean, we got a little bit of a cross-cultural audience here. Would anyone say no to this question? Okay, now you realize there are places in the world where the answer to this question is no. They say, how is it possible to live that way? I remember when I went to Malaysia, and I was in the small village in Malaysia that was doing subsistence farming. And I was there with my international friend, and I started to observe their life, that they would go out each day, they would catch some fish, they would harvest some crops, and they would just, they wouldn't do a lot of other work, and they would sit there. And I say, man, don't you want to develop like an export business in here? Then you could build things up, and maybe, and I started thinking, like, how could life improve in this village? And I started to get the response, like, well, why would we want to do that? We're just happy enjoying our life here. We got enough to eat. We're in good relationships with one another. Why do we have to do something else? Like, I don't understand that. That was my experience of people who are living a relatively simple life who didn't see that it was necessary to have a lot of long-range goals or a lot of other goals. That was okay with them. Now, I think when the Westerners came into that village to preach the gospel, they said that they wanted to see life differently there. They thought people would be better that way. So they brought in an electric generator so they could have electricity. When I was there, the generator was broken. I said, how long has it been broken for? They said, oh, like about 3 years. I said, aren't you going to get repaired? I mean, this is my thinking again, you know. Well, maybe. You know, it wasn't like a high priority for them to fix the generator. So obviously, what the person who brought the generator in to improve their, and I say, now, that's not true for all people. A lot of people do want to improve in their economic situation. But I think the type of drivenness and the type of, well, we got to keep getting more and more, and that is not in a lot of places. Now, we might consider that a weakness. If we consider this a superior value, we'd say it's a weakness if people don't have that competitive type of drivenness. Is it? What do you think? We could have a good discussion about that, but that is, okay, so let's take another one. Do you think there is more than one way of solving a problem and that creative solutions to problems should be encouraged? Anyone have a problem with that one? Anyone say, no, I don't think that's necessarily the best way? Okay, see, I think we are taught, and this is generally a value, that we think it's good to be creative in your thinking. You know, there's a lot of cultures where the idea is you should learn, you should be taught what is right and accept it. And therefore, the education system is more based on memorization of predetermined answers. This is the correct answer. You learn it. Learn it from the expert, and that's the way you learn. Find out who already knows the answer, sit under them, and learn it. So actually, a lot of international students who come to the United States, when they come into American classrooms and they're being asked their opinion or asked to contribute, it's very difficult for them because they've been raised in a different cultural environment. So this is not accepted in many parts of the world as being the best way. So we can keep going down this list. Let's see. Let's do number six. Do you think that you can make a decision for yourself without having to consult others? Now, it's interesting. We have the wider culture and we have the Christian culture. And when we move into the Christian culture, many times we are taught, hey, we need in our discipleship relationships to get counsel and input. And so we move in a different direction. We start to move away from our cultural there. But I think still in this question, the idea that maybe, and maybe it goes relates to another question. Let's see. Number 14, yeah, kind of relates to 14. Yeah, they all kind of relate, but in some cultures, what your major is going to be in school, you don't decide that. You don't decide who you're going to marry. You don't decide where you're going to live. I mean, these are decisions that are made for you. And if you have an American value, say, what? Someone's going to tell me those things. I have the right to decide those things. Okay. You're dealing with a really big cross-cultural difference here. Now, if when you view that difference, you say, man, that is just so bad. How could people be like that? That's bondage. Well, there's bondage in both ways, right? Every culture has the out of the value can be a bondage situation. But, okay, you get the point here? So if you read this, this doesn't mean that you should stop having a cultural preference. It doesn't mean it's wrong to want to do something in a certain way. That's not saying that. The issue is when someone does it in a different way, do you conclude it's inferior or worse or shouldn't be done that way? If you do, then you're getting into the problem here that we're talking about of either pride or openness. I have a lot of preferences in the way I like to live. I am an American. And as a Christian, even though I want to live with the kingdom values, I still have those preferences of how things are done. I've learned to be flexible. I've learned to accept those things and try and understand them, but I still have a preference. I still prefer to line up rather than go through that system of trying to get in there and get my food or whatever, my ticket, whatever it's going to be. Okay, we're going to need to move more quickly. Okay, so second quality and second skill that we're going to learn, the depth of acceptance, the ability to communicate value, worth, and esteem to another person. So again, you can see this actually has a lot to do with honor as well. One of the ways that we show acceptance of another person is to want to learn from them and to connect with them. Language learning is very important for showing acceptance. One of the things that Americans are, it's very interesting about the fact that many people in the world want to learn English. And English is the communicative language. There are some people who feel like that American dominance in the world, even with language, is a type of cultural imperialism because Americans are unwilling to learn other languages. So we need to see from the standpoint, if you're on the other side and Americans don't take any efforts to learn language and they expect that they're going to learn English, you can see how that can come across and could be an attitude problem. So we should try, like even though I didn't learn Chinese, I try and learn Chinese expressions at least. And other expressions. When I make an international friend, I try and learn how to say hello in their language at least. Just learning hello speaks volumes to people, that their faces will light up. They will respond to you differently if you say hello in their language. And I think everybody can learn to say hello in the language of someone else, right? And other expressions that would be helpful to communicate, I want to accept you. I think another part of that is when you are offered something, that you receive it, and you receive it without criticism. Now, this happens in many simple ways. It's very broad, but let me give you an example. I know a lot of times with food differences, when someone is presented a food that they're not used to eating, now, this is, again, where you can have preferences. I mean, even in your home, you have preferences, but when you see something that you consider strange, if your reaction is, ooh, how could somebody eat that? Okay, now you may be just expressing the way you feel, but the communication is there's something wrong with people who eat that type of food, and it's not an acceptance. Now, I've been in lots of situations with Americans where that's happened. We've gone to a restaurant, an ethnic restaurant, and people order their food, and they look and they say, oh, how can you eat that? That is not the way to communicate acceptance, okay? Now, it's even better, not everyone has the same ability to eat certain foods, and you know, it's okay. If you're able to stretch, to taste things and do that, that shows an acceptance, and most friends are not going to force things on you. But if you try, that really communicates something about the person that you're trying to build a relationship with, if you're willing to accept their food And I'm going to talk more about food in the hospitality section. I have a Nigerian friend who invited me for lunch, and he decided to serve me soup. The name of the soup was pepper soup. And I think the only thing it had in it was water and pepper. I think that's why they call it pepper soup. But, you know, so I'm going to have this soup. I started eating the soup, and it was the hottest spicy soup I've ever eaten. And I'm trying, and I'm crying, and heat is rising off of my head. And finally, I looked at him, and he's laughing at me. He's just laughing. I said, "Well, Coma, it's wonderful soup, but I just can't have any more." And he's laughing. So we had a good time. But he saw I was trying to eat it, you know, and that's, I do try and do that whenever I go. I enjoy trying different types of food. So, okay, wait patiently. Second thing is, a lot of acceptance has to do with patience. The more impatient we are, the less we show acceptance of another person. We can be impatient about many things. I find myself, usually, by God's grace, I'm patient, but I know in the, just even recently, when I was in India, and we were going to go from one city to another on the bus, and the plan had been, he told me that we were going to go to the bus at 5 o'clock and go to this other city. And I knew the bus stop was about 15 minutes away, and it got to be about 4:30. And I didn't see any movement. And I'm starting to feel inside of me that, like, shouldn't we get going, you know, kind of deal. And then I said, I'm not going to say anything. But I was finally, at 4:45, I did say, "You know, it's 4:45. The bus leaves at 5. Aren't we supposed to go?" He said, "Oh, don't worry about it. You know, there'll be another bus afterwards." I said, okay. You know, so I had to readjust myself to the situation. He wasn't anxious about it. Actually, we missed the next bus too, and, you know, and it was fine. He wasn't stressed at all. I needed to learn to be patient in that situation. That there's a lot of situations like that. Okay. Allow others to give to us. Now, this is goes back to that helping search. Part of acceptance shows a willingness to receive. If you are the only giver, the relationship is disproportionate. In fact, people coming from honor-based cultures, if you give them too much and they can't give back, they will withdraw from the relationship because they feel guilty, or they feel guilty. They feel like the imbalance in the relationship if they are not in a position to be able to give. So you have to provide opportunities for people to give to you as well and to receive them. If you're just a helper, if that's all you're doing to people, that does not show acceptance, actually. So we have to be able to do that. Develop flexibility, avoid dogmatism. That's kind of a repeat, a little bit of the first point. Avoid evaluative language. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Sometimes we assume that because we think they speak English well, that we understand what they're saying.
Yes.
And I've got myself in trouble with my Nigerian coworkers because I think because they speak great English, and sometimes I quickly jump on the words that he said. And recently coming home, I left, you know, ministry wise, I left a large sum of money for him. And then 2 days after I'm here, I get an email saying, "I need more money." And I was like, "You went through a month's worth, you know, in my mind, you went through a month's worth of money, ministry money, in 2 days." But it wasn't that he was out of money, it's just something else came up and he was holding this money to address the need that it was for. But I quickly could have gone and did go to
Yeah.
And so we have to be careful of listening to understand. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, I'm not going to get through this. No, I wasn't saying anything critical, but I'm just realizing. Okay, let me go this. Trust is that the definition is the ability to build confidence in a relationship so that both parties believe the other will not intentionally hurt them, will act in their best interest. And obviously, to trust someone means you're going to have to get to know them better. Trust is built over a period of time, It has to do with seeing a person's character. And so you don't usually trust people right away, although there is always a risk involved in trusting people that you're going to be taken advantage of. And I think that we love always trusts. And so we, if people do not sense that we trust them, we are not going to be able to build the relationship. And trusting them has to do with trusting them with our things, trusting them with responsibilities, trusting them. I see a lot of ministry situations that are imbalanced because people never entrust or empower the people that they're working with to leadership positions, and they're always feeling like, okay, you know, we are the lesser ones. It's that pride situation again. So one of the things that builds trust is the way you work through conflict. And the reality is, in every relationship that you're going to build, there are going to be some misunderstandings. There's going to be some difficulties. This is critical then if you're going to build a successful cross-cultural relationship and you know there's going to be misunderstandings and difficulties, how you approach them is very important. Now, you, from your standpoint, you have to admit when you're wrong and you have to forgive when you're offended. But you need to learn how to communicate indirectly. And I say this because the other difficult thing for developing successful cross-cultural relationships is because most cultures in the world are indirect communicators. When we communicate directly, that tends to damage the relationship when we're trying to solve it, when we're trying to solve problems. We have been taught in the West that maybe the only model that Jesus taught about reconciliating in relationships is the Matthew 18 model, going directly to the person. We really emphasize that a lot. If you want to solve a problem, go and talk directly to the person. In a lot of cultures, that is like considered to be too aggressive. And indirect approaches to conflict solving are used much more regularly in other cultures. Now, if we tend to view those as unbiblical, we forget that Jesus himself was a mediator. We forget that Jesus also talked about peacemakers, that other people getting involved in conflict resolution is not a bad thing if it's done in the right way. And so being able to pick up both, well, it's really hard to learn indirect communication when we're from a direct culture. But I think part of learning this skill is very important, and it's one of the most difficult things to learn. So how do you learn this? You need a trainer. You need someone who can train you to listen and understand cues, because that's what happens in other cultures. You will get cues or little hints about things that when you pick them up, when you can start to pick them up. For example, most people from honor cultures cannot say no. Like I talked about the situation of the person asking for help, the person cannot say no to that. If you give a person an invitation, they cannot say no because that's rude. If you are offering something to someone and they say no, it's kind of like impolite. So you have to know when someone says yes to you, when it means maybe or no. Now you say, well, aren't they being dishonest? Aren't they being devious? We have all these encouragements. Just say it directly, you know, give it to me straight. But there is a biblical value on truth-telling that is very much emphasized in Western culture. It's emphasized in the Bible. There's also a very strong emphasis on harmony in relationships in the Bible. That also is a biblical value. So the fact that other cultures put a greater emphasis on that aspect rather than on the truth-telling aspect doesn't mean that they're unbiblical. It just means they're emphasizing something else. You have to struggle with that one. Okay. Now let me... I want to have another hour. That's what I want. Let's see. I want to show you a video because I think this video, in 2 minutes, can convey a lot about the first three attitudes and skills that I'm talking about. And look for the three things. Look for openness, acceptance, and trust in these 2 minutes. Can you get the light? Thank you.
Thank you.
And indeed, in the morning, he does become a new man, if you know the story. You can get the light there again. Okay, what you're going to have to do is read through. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to explain all of the other three attitudes and skills that you should grow in order to become a cross-cultural servant. But they're there. You can read the notes and look at the book if you want. Does anyone have a question that you came in here with that you really, you know, were hoping would be answered? I didn't get to. Something in the notes that you wanted to know more about? I'll explain. There's another handout in the back called Form and Function in the Church. I talked about Western values and how they impact our cross-cultural relationships. The second sheet is meant to help you to think more deeply about how your Christian community and Christian culture impacts the way that you start to relate to imposing things on another culture from a pride standpoint as well. In other words, the temptation is that the way we do our Christian faith also is imposed on other people, and by not being able to separate out the functions of our faith from the forms of our faith. The functions are the universal principles that should be practiced by people in every culture to be faithful to the teaching of the Bible. The forms are the way those practices or those values look within the culture. And so the forms and function sheet, some of them will be quite easy for you who come from a background that you were already reacting against traditional forms in Christianity, and you said, hey, we don't want to do it that way anymore, we're going to change. But some of them are still going to be more challenging for you. When you look at that questions that are on that form and function, it will cause you to ask, really? Is that possible? For example, one of the questions there, it's on the back of the, how Western are you? 15, can a Jesus follower worship God in a mosque? Okay, that would be one. Maybe another one would be, how about number 5? Is abstaining from food sacrificed to idols and from meat from animals that have been strangled and from sexual immorality an issue of form or function? Okay. So you can look at those and discuss them, or maybe you should take that, go through and find someone to discuss those with, and then that would help you. The form is like the wineskin, yes. Okay, under trust, and then I'll quit with this one then, and then if you have specific questions. By the way, before I answer that question, I must tell you, okay, the ministry that I'm engaged with, International Friendships, is not only here in Columbus, but in other places, and we're wanting to serve help international student ministry in other places. The passport that you were given out is a way that if you have any interest in serving international students, because there's a great opportunity that God has given us in sending the nations here, if you would fill that form out and give it to me, I will give you some more information. If you live in another city, I can connect you to an international student ministry in that city. One of the needs that we have is, if you want to be a cross-cultural servant, when people come to this country, they arrive usually with two suitcases, they move into empty apartments, and we're going to have a big day where we're going to provide furniture to people. Which date is it?
August 23rd.
So anyone in Columbus, we need lots of help for that event, to carry the furniture and to take people, drive students to the garage sales and to the shopping sales. So that's something on that form that I think you could indicate as well. But okay, one of the things that is a huge difference in serving people from other cultures is the time difference. And the time difference has to do with the difference between chronological time, where you plan things, and the kairos time, which is the moment or opportunity where you can do something only then. That's the only time it's available. And a lot of cultures are much more oriented toward what's happening at the moment. That's why in the one question on the Western cultural thing, it asked, if you have an appointment with someone and on the way to that appointment you meet someone on the way who wants to talk, do you tell them, I'm sorry, I have an appointment that I have to keep, or do you stop and talk to that person for even an extended time, even though the other person is going to be kept waiting? Many cultures, they stop because their belief is that what's happening right then is the most important thing, and that even though you had an appointment, that person has to understand that something else came up, because that's the way life is. So I think that many times in our situation, because we are much more oriented toward chronos time, we might miss what the opportunity is right then because we're scheduled too much. We're so much oriented toward keeping things on an appointment. We know that one of the things that is true in most relationships around the world is if you make an appointment, you've moved into a formal type of business relationship. And yet, the reality is when we want to develop friendships in America, usually we make appointments. Can I get together with you for lunch? It sounds very nice, and it is very nice. But for other cultures, it's kind of like if you have to set up the appointment, it's already become formal. You just do it. You just stop over. You just say, hey, got some food, let's eat together. You know, stop by any time. That type of fluidity and where you're getting together is considered more of a friendship than the more scheduled type of getting together. That's very hard to live in American culture. Very hard. But that's what people come from in their cultural backgrounds, many people. So that's what I mean by the flexibility to just recognize you have a moment in time. Like I knew one of the things was a missionary in a Muslim country was having a meeting with his teammates to discuss their ministry and how they were going to work with Muslims. And so they had this meeting planned. It was an all-day meeting, and there's a knock at the door. And his friend that he's reaching out to has shown up and says, hey, what you doing? Now, if he says to that person, I'm sorry, I got a meeting right now. I can't spend any time with you. But in his mind, you know, hey, this is the meeting that was planned with these guys. Which way is he going to go? Yeah. If he says no to that guy, it may be the lost opportunity. That's right. That's right. Okay, let me close in prayer. And Lord, thanks so much for the people that were here today. And I know that they're listening to lots of information, lots of things in the talks that are being given today. But I pray that you would, by your Holy Spirit, show us those particular things that we need to begin to do and put into place, and the attitudes where they need to change. And Lord, everyone was here because they want to grow in their ability to relate cross-culturally. And so I pray that you would just show something from this session that people could use. And Lord, as a result of it, I pray that we could be better servants in this world to reveal you to others. In Jesus' name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.